we assume that patients really want to manage their health information. We assume that patients want access to their medical records. Patients mostly want to be cared for.
Dr. Sachin Jain brings a very particular set of skills to his role as CMO of CareMore. Today we'll learn how he got here and how he plans to leverage his talent and experience to reshape care delivery.
This is Tectonics, the podcast focused on the people and passion at the intersection of technology and health. I'm Lisa Soonan.
And I'm David Shaywitz.
Ready, champ?
I've been ready for this my whole life.
Then you take us out on the field.
All right. So this is probably the third best invocation of Notre Dame in a movie, after Newt Rockne with Reagan as George Gipp, and of course Airplane. But here's why I wanted this clip. When I started to think about your career trajectory, Sachin. Son of a physician, government major in college, MD, MBA with experience working for health policy giants Don Berwick and David Blumenthal, several years as CMIO at Merck. It seems like the perfect training for a physician change leader, which it sounds like you've always aspired to be. Did the call from CareMore feel like your Rudy moment? And how the hell does someone get it into his head that he wants to be a physician administrator when he grows up?
You know, it's funny. I hadn't thought about it until you brought it up today. But yes, it did feel like that moment. I had been looking for an opportunity where I could work in an innovative healthcare delivery system for, I would say, a really long time. Took me a while to actually figure out
to find
what an innovative delivery system actually looks like. For a while, I thought I was Diogenes, kind of looking for an honest man or looking for an honest health system that was sort of interested
See,
in really
changing. See, the
Harvard
guy with a little sophisticated classical
reference. I know, look at that.
There.
I know, always Harvard.
But ultimately was just really thrilled when I had the opportunity to join CareMore as its chief medical officer. As you know, CareMore is an organization with innovation in its bones, has been in the reinventing healthcare business, for 20-some-odd years now. And so the opportunity to kind of join it as its leader was really just very exciting for me.
So what's so great about it? Why did it stand out to you?
So for one thing, what I first heard about it when I was at CMS, and we were looking for examples of organizations that were achieving the triple aim. CareMore had really built a model of care that was improving quality and reducing costs for, frankly, the most vulnerable populations in the Medicare program. And so I just was very excited about the opportunity to join it.
Are they similar to the way you, do you think about them in a similar bucket to folks like ChenMed and Eora Health, or are they different?
I would say it's very different. So, when you get into the sort of, the primary care startup space, a lot of the organizations that are working in that space are fundamentally changing primary care on the margins. You go into the guts of those practices, they very much are still doing primary care and in the same ways that we've always done primary care. One of the things that's exciting about CareMore is that we're transforming primary care outside the walls of the primary care practice. We're extending the capabilities of primary care providers through care centers and through the use of extensivist physicians so that you're able to actually build it onto, the existing primary care infrastructure, as opposed to fundamentally reshaping, the work of people who've been practicing medicine the same way for 25 years. They find it very difficult. They find it very challenging. You're well aware of kind of the I think, growing sense of disenchantment among American physicians, largely because there are an extraordinary number of mandates that are just being layered on to primary care physicians. What we're doing is we're taking a lot of the difficult work that exists within primary care and putting it into a new place, which is a care center where you can actually access, high-quality chronic disease management for the most frail elderly.
So does this mean you can't fix the doctors? You got to work around them?
No, I think what it means is that you can't throw everything on top of the same group of people. I think you have to actually you can't get more out of a system without adding more to a system. And so what we've done, I think, is taken a lot of the difficult and challenging work of primary care and put it somewhere else in ways that free up primary care doctors to actually be primary care doctors.
Now, when people talk about making systems more efficient or taking cost out of it, at the end of the day, it always seems to me to involve making the network more narrow. What I want to know is how much is sort of narrow network this central to this, and everything else is, you know, a cynic would say, oh, it's fundamentally about a narrow network and everything else is sort of like bells and whistles that are almost distractions versus really driving the value by all the other approaches that are being included.
Yeah, so there's narrow network for cost cutting, and then there's narrow network for, you know, incorporating clinicians who actually practice medicine the way we think it should be practiced. And I think that's the way we approach it, is we're looking for
a few good men and women.
Yeah, exactly.
So is technology a key aspect in what you do, or is it more about people?
I think it's, you know, I think all of healthcare begins and ends with people. I think technology enables those people to do their jobs better. But fundamentally, it's about a human connection between, you know, someone who cares for a patient and a patient or a family. And so we do integrate, I think, technology in sort of important ways into our clinical practice. But it's technology to enable clinicians to care. I'll give you a couple of examples. We're pioneers in the healthcare industry in terms of using remote monitoring technologies. If you look at most of the studies on remote monitoring technologies, you know, that come from academic centers, the jury says that, you know, they don't work. And they don't work because they don't get bolted into the, you know, care delivery infrastructure in a way that actually works for patients. What we've done is we've actually made it a big part of how they actually receive care. And so when you have a CHF patient who, you know, is suffering and has multiple readmissions over the course of a month, we're able to give them a home scale, and we'll equip them with a scale, a cellular modem, and we'll know on a daily basis whether they're stepping on the scale. And if they're not stepping on the scale, we'll either call them or we'll visit them at home. And that's the way we're using technology to really enable patients.
Have the patients who you've brought this technology to, how has that adoption been? I mean, we've heard even from a previous guest about how when digital health technologies are brought into the clinic, Dr. Brendan Spiegel, you know him, down from Southern California, you know, it was sort of a mixed experience where, you know, sometimes sensors fall off, sometimes people are like, what are you doing with all this technology? I don't want to bother with this technology. What has your experience been of consumer adoption of this?
Particularly among the Medicare crowd.
You have to know your patients, and you have to know that, you know, there's no one-size-fits-all. And, you know, the technologies and solutions that work for one group of patients isn't going to work for the next group of patients. Yeah, it is true personalized medicine. I mean, I think that at the end of the day, you can't expect, you know, a 75-year-old, you know, multimorbid patient taking 17 medicines to be the same as, you know, your 65-year-old new Medicare retiree who he or she feels like, you know, feels like they're 30 years old. What we're seeing is that our population is actually aging. We now have CareMore members who've been CareMore members for 15, 20 years. And so, you know, you have to meet people where they are.
How did you get here? Like, how did you, you know, your background isn't really from the delivery system side, right?
It is from the delivery system side, in the sense that, you know, I think from a very early age, I've kind of been eating, you know, drinking and sleeping delivery system stuff. I think I took a little bit of a diversion when I went to work in pharma for a couple of years. But for the most part, my passion has really been around care delivery reform and innovation.
And even when you were at Merck, I mean, you were looking, you had a very broad remit, as I understand it, where you were able to partner with novel organizations. Has it been a transition for you to experience sort of the issues from the pharma side and then from the payer side?
You know, I would say it's actually given me a different set of tools and approaches to thinking about, you know, the same set of problems. And I would also say, you know, some of what I learned at Merck was how to navigate and operate within, you know, a large and complex and multi-matrix organization.
In case your experience in the government and at the Brigham hadn't taught you that.
But ultimately, I think, you know, that those, you know, because healthcare delivery is so complicated, and because there's employed physicians and network physicians and network hospitals, I think, you know, that sort of sense of how to operate within the matrix is something that's definitely helped me as I've transitioned into my new role.
Was there assumptions about payers that you thought were intrinsic at pharma, for example, that when you've been on the payer side, you realize, well, maybe pharma shouldn't have these assumptions? Are they kind of accurate what they think?
So we don't really think of ourselves as a payer. We think of ourselves as a delivery system with a Medicare Advantage payment model that supports our delivery system. So, you know, most of what we operate from an operations perspective are delivery assets, not necessarily payer assets. And so
really more of an integrated delivery.
Yeah, we have, you know, we have care centers.
But you're owned by...
We're owned by Anthem, but ultimately, you know, we are one of Anthem's delivery assets.
So how does that go? I mean, it's such an interesting experience with the payer world now, the insurer world now, right? They're trying to become providers at the same time because obviously they can't profit in the same way they did from just the pure insurance side anymore. They're trying to become technology companies. You know, they're diversifying in a profound kind of way. Does that work? Can that work? I mean, if you, in the context of Anthem or in the context of what you've seen in others,
I think we're proof that it can work. I mean, we are, I think, achieving, you know, extraordinary outcomes from a clinical and cost perspective, you know, within a large company context. I mean, and what I'll tell you is Anthem is enabling us to take a CareMore model now to other settings. So, you know, in Southern California, where we started, we're both payer and we're delivery system. Now, because of our relationships with Amerigroup, which is one of our sister Anthem companies, we're now able to take a CareMore approach to, you know, Medicaid. And so we're now in Tennessee, and we've built our first installation of what we call CareMore Essentials, which is where we operate as a delivery system and not necessarily as a payer in a Medicaid context.
What's your secret sauce? What do you do that other people should learn from?
I think the secret sauce is that we just stay connected to our patients. Every couple of weeks, I get to have lunch with our patients, and these are always the most, you know, illuminating conversations. And we see them as members, not necessarily as patients in that context, because they're not, you know, seeking care. And
how does that work? You got a standing invitation, whoever wants to show up for lunch?
When I got to CareMore, I said, I really want to talk to members. I said, that's how I was going to actually get frontline insights in terms of what's actually going on with them. And their number one complaint is that they hear from us too much, which is a great complaint from my perspective. It means, I mean, we have to, I think, streamline the experience, and we have to make sure that we're not harassing them per se.
Well, they'll tune you out if you over annoy them, right?
Right. No, absolutely. Absolutely. But their number one concern is that, you know, they hear from us too much, and they get called into the care centers to do all kinds of different visits. And that, to me, is the secret sauce. They come in for toenail clipping, which is one of the services we offer. And in the course of coming in for toenail clipping, we'll ask them about their blood pressure. We'll ask them about their medicines. And that, I think, creates many touch points. And that's what's missing, I think, in healthcare. I think it's what we used to have in some ways, is that it was actually easy to access the system. There were multiple touch points. And what we're adding back to the system, I think, is that sort of close relationship between delivery system and patient.
I realize I'm missing out here, because when I get a pedicure, they don't ask me about, you know, my blood pressure. And they offer me a glass of wine sometimes, but, you know.
You're going to some high-class pedicure places if you're getting wine.
Exactly.
So.
But in terms of, is this a general, what prevents this from being general? Or do you think it's, or from either other players from generalizing it, or what prevents you from offering it more places?
One of the most fundamental philosophical differences between CareMore and other organizations is we view capitation as freedom as opposed to risk. And we view it as an opportunity for us to actually do what needs to be done for patients. And I think it's one of the huge distinctions that exists between care in a Medicare Advantage sort of capitation model versus ACOs, where, you know, it's fundamentally built on a fee-for-service chassis. There have to be codes for what you're doing. Otherwise, it doesn't necessarily make sense to do it. In our context, if it makes sense to deliver a service to a member, we can do it. And I think that that's the real opportunity.
Well, you really own the risk.
Exactly.
Now, isn't the concern with this type of approach is that people don't, you know, if they get sick, you're sort of like, well, wouldn't you really rather go to hospice versus have a more intensive therapy? Or wouldn't you really rather, isn't there a concern that there's sort of like a Logan's Run type of
That's
approach?
Where having a strong professional culture that's kind of focused on the patient is the most important thing. And that's something that, you know, we've, I think, done a really good job of building and preserving within CareMore.
What are the safeguards, though? I mean, I'm not trying to overly, you know, I mean, clearly there are a lot of, a lot of people are very enthusiastic. I mean, you have quotes, I think you even tweeted it, from Bob Koch or from Zeke Emanuel. So, you know, like, oh, this is sort of people like Zeke doesn't think there should be, like, there will be insurance companies in the future, but he loves the CareMore approach, right? But a concern that some other folks have with the general approach is that, geez, isn't this just going to lead to essentially reduction in the amount of
the HMO of the future?
Yeah, like sort of HMO redux, right?
Yeah.
Well, I think that's where it's really important to have strong professional standards and professional culture and good clinical leadership. I mean, that we are a largely clinician-driven organization, and so
far as I would be happy.
I think because we're clinician-driven, we're leading with medicine and good science, and you know, practicing the kind of medicine that I think, you know, we think patients should receive.
Was your father a physician?
He is. Yeah, my father
is a physician.
He is a physician. Yeah.
And so, how does this differ? This culturally differ from the way you kind of learning about doctors, or?
Yeah, I mean, it's culturally different in the sense that my father was, most of his career was an academic physician. Was focused on teaching, research, education.
He founded the pain service at Sloan Kettering, right?
He did. That's right. He was practicing in a super specialized center where, you did absolutely everything. You know, it was sort of a center of last resort. I think we see ourselves as, this integration of, I think, payer and delivery system, I think, again, creates many different opportunities for us to actually help our patients. The fact that we go to our patients' home and do home visits, the fact that we do have remote monitoring technologies, the fact that we do things like toenail clippings, you know, these are not things that academic medical centers are actually thinking about. Mm-hmm. They wouldn't necessarily see that as their job.
Right.
So
what does your dad think when you tell him you've got team of people doing toenail clippings?
He thinks it's fantastic. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think, you know, he, you know, recognizes the value of kind of, I think, touching patients at multiple places. So,
mm-hmm.
Absolutely. He was actually here a couple of weeks ago and had a chance to visit our care centers and meet with some of our staff. And, you know, he was, I think, really blown away by very strong clinical culture that we have.
He must have been felling like crazy.
Yeah, exactly. So what was your family like growing up?
Oh, I was the youngest of three brothers. Three brothers. Sort of got beat up a little bit by my older brothers. I will always be their younger brother. Grew up in, you know, northern New Jersey, as that sort of part of the world was changing pretty rapidly.
Lisa's going to ask what exit.
Yeah, right?
No, not what exit. Yeah, there's, you know, we're Bergen County.
Princeton,
just
myself.
Right outside of New York City.
It's the Harvard of New Jersey, David.
I was told that Princeton is where people from New Jersey want to be from who don't want to be from New Jersey.
You know, and I have several aunts and uncles in healthcare, most of them still in India, actually all of them still in India. And we have a strong kind of philanthropic connection to India. My aunt has kind of devoted her whole life to doing rural healthcare. And so kind of healthcare for the underserved was something that was just a part of what our family does and something that I felt like, you know, would always be part of what I wanted to do when I was a physician.
Interesting. So that's such an interesting culture over there, and what's going on is it modernizes and becoming, I think, more of a profit or revenue-based culture.
It's the purest, purest form of consumer-directed healthcare mm-hmm. that I've ever seen
in the
world.
Can you help explain that?
Yeah, I mean, you know, if you talk to the consumer-directed healthcare zealots, they'll tell you, you know, you have to, you know, sort of make it all about, you know, the patient making a decision. And there's obviously, I think, challenges with that as it relates to imperfect information between, you know, patients and providers, sort of huge price discrepancies, huge examples of overuse of services. So it's really, you know, health plans are not a big part of the healthcare landscape in India. And so you have patients who go to clinicians and they either trust them or they don't trust them. And they have a lot of either procedures done or not done. I will tell you that of my seven uncles, all of them have been cathed at this point, and most of them probably didn't meet criteria for actually getting cathed.
And so why does that happen?
It happens because, you know, you have a, you maybe you have stable angina, you go to see a cardiologist and they say, we should cath you. But I would say, you know, in India, the sort of direct-to-consumerness of it all scares me a little bit.
So in the world that, I mean, you come from a world of multicultural world and you now work in one that's, I'm sure, very multicultural, that's got to be really interesting in how you think about delivering care to people. It's so variant in the different, you know, nationalities, what people are interested in having or doing.
It's one of my kind of fundamental kind of principles as a clinician is to really assume nothing about the patient. I mean, I think one of the big mistakes we make as a healthcare industry is we try to assume so much about what patients want and what patients
need. Can you give an example?
It actually drives me a little bit crazy. So one of the things that we assume that patients really want to manage their health information. We assume that patients want access to their medical records. Patients mostly want to be cared for. There are some patients who want their access to their medical records and they want to be able to do things with them, and God bless them if they have the time and the energy and the willingness to do it.
So you're going to go in the octagon with Eric Topol?
But I think most patients really just want to be cared for by their health system. They want their preferences respected. We assume that many patients don't want to be told what the right treatment is, that they want to make their own decisions. You know, my parents are now Medicare age or nearing Medicare age. And my mother would be the first person to tell you that she just wants the doctor to check. It actually drives her crazy that her doctor says, well, what do you want? And my mother says, well, you're the doctor. You should tell me what I want, what I should want. And not everyone's like that, but we shouldn't assume that patients don't want, you know, a paternalistic physician. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they do.
I think it's true. And I think the other thing that's so interesting is in a population with lots of illness, there's so many mental health issues oftentimes that are, you know, intertwined in these things, depression or whatever it may be, and that so many different folks from different cultures don't want to talk about that. You know, that's a real taboo.
Well, it's
in many
a huge
cultures.
Area of strength and focus for CareMore is the behavioral health integration. I mean, we think that behavioral health is sort of a foundational kind of component to...
It's the ultimate primary care.
Every chronic disease has a behavioral health component, whether we like to admit it or not. And so it's something that we are, we actively integrate into, you know, our primary care model as well as our inpatient model of care.
One of the things that you've done at Merck, for example, was evaluate emerging technologies, as I understand it, especially, including as it applied to care delivery. There's been so much hype, but also as someone in a position where you really care if it works or not. I mean, ultimately, if it improves care and saves me, you know, triple aim stuff, it's better for you. What have you seen that seems most promising, whether in the area of behavioral health or in other areas, from the emerging technology front, in addition to the Wi-Fi enabled scale for heart failure,
right,
that you really feel has been unexpectedly promising in actual implementation?
So I think it's actually hard to point to many, many things that actually meet that threshold. And I think it goes back to what I was saying about the remote monitoring scales, which, you know, we do remote blood pressure monitoring, remote weight scales, as well as remote blood sugar monitoring, is that the fundamental kind of gap is the integration with care delivery. It's an argument that I've, you know, an argument that I had with Jamie Haywood a few years ago around patients like me. You know, focused on, you know, Jamie and I were involved in a one of our projects at Merck on building a community of patients for psoriasis. And you know, psoriasis is very different than ALS, which is where patients like me sort of got its start. And, you know, I think the big question patients want to know is, by contributing my data, how's it actually going to really benefit me? And there was a very, you know, I think clear case of how it could benefit you with ALS. It was not as clear with psoriasis. And so, you know, one of the things I've been pushing on folks who do build, you know, patient-oriented communities is, can you build a link back to care delivery where sharing your information on a regular basis will somehow influence your clinicians' treatment decisions or impressions of your disease severity, so that
or
you
give you a royalty
that,
on the drug that Merck might whatever, create,
whatever,
out of it, whatever,
and create a virtuous cycle.
Well, so do you like approaches such as, or when you consider approaches sort of like, as an example, Propeller Health, where the idea is it's a device that sits on the end. I don't have any relationship with the company. It's just an interesting technology. It sits on the edge of an inhaler, and if people initially the idea was that if people use it, I guess in their second iteration, if people use it during an exacerbation, the physician knows. So the idea is the physician can monitor a population of asthmatics and figure out who is most likely at risk. Is that how
that's exactly right? So you know if it can actually connect back to the clinical decision making. I think there's a much...
Where does that break down, the connection back to the...
It breaks down on what I said before, you know, to start this interview, which is that we are unfortunately, the way we've tried to create change in the healthcare system is we keep pushing stuff into the physician's clinical practice. We don't do anything easy anything to make it easy for physicians to actually use this technology. We just say, okay, we've got this new technology. Primary care doctor, go use it. We've got this other new technology, go use it. And ultimately, I think creating a care center platform where you can do chronic disease management that has this sort of IT interface with your primary care can actually take a lot of this hard work and put it in the hands of, you know, NPs, medical assistants, who can actually do it in a team-based way with your primary care.
It's interesting. So that makes me think of two points. One of the things people talk about is the idea of, in a sense, the workflow. And people say that as things have gotten digitized, it's been more an example of digitizing shitty workflow versus trying to reinvent a workflow. On the other hand, anyone discussing adoption will say, if you make people do things completely different, and Bob Wachter has all of these stories, then they don't even know what to do. He said one day that he describes an office that adopted an EMR and everyone showed up and didn't know what to do. They just sat there and was staring at it. You know, so you can
That's exactly right. And so there has to be kind of a real connection to the patient. There has to be a real effort to actually lead change management with the clinicians and do so in a way that doesn't, you know, sort of disturb their lives. I think that that's such an important part here. In our focus on patient-centeredness, we've lost a little bit of a focus on our clinician workforce. And I think it's one of the real tensions that we need to address as a healthcare system over the next 5 to 10 years, which is we need to simultaneously become more patient-centered while we actually also become clinician-centered. And I don't think that the two are actually, as much opposition as, you know, the statement would suggest. But we need to, you know, I think take care of our healthcare workforce. Taking care of sick patients who've got a lot of chronic diseases and who have a lot of needs is draining work. And it becomes even more draining when you keep adding and layering on new things for people to do. And so making people's jobs simpler is going to be a key to actually improving health.
One of the interesting, blog posts that I read recently was from one of the folks at the Incidental Economist, where they were describing how essentially the requirements creep, how as there are more and more obligations, things for a physician to do. And this is in terms of more best practices, but you can also imagine what you're describing is people say, oh, if only primary care doctors would do this, if only they would do this. And there's some isolated study that just looks at if they did this, if they did action A, outcome B is improved. But then the flip side is there's sort of a cost to doing all of those different things. And when there are too many different things to focus on, you can't do any of them. And then you start losing your effectiveness.
I love that example because, you know, you're right. It's isolating sort of if you do A, you'll get B, without realizing that if you do A, you're not going to be doing C, D, E, and F. Yeah, so.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today. We both enjoy following you on Twitter. We hope you continue to write as much as you have in the past, even with your new role. And we're so glad you joined us on the show today.
Yeah, thank you so much. It was fascinating.
It's great to be here. Thanks so much.
Dude, be articulate.
Right? I mean, geez.
So well-spoken.
So interesting to hear him think about and talk about and process all those learnings he had from his youth and his growing up in a doctor's home in India and all that and how he's brought that to bear.
In the current health system. He's the right person to be thinking about it. It'll be interesting to see how it evolves.
And for those of you who enjoyed the podcast today, please find the rest of them either on my blog, adventurevalkyrie.com, or on the Apple iTunes website.
Absolutely, and you can find some of my writing at forbes.com. Thank you so much for listening. I'm David Chewitz.
And I'm Lisa Soonan.